Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're literally, folks, we're wrapping up the final amendments to the Articles of Confederation. Now, we've got Paul with us. He's going to help us get across the finish line here, because the whole reason why we're going through all of this, right? The only reason we talked about, the Articles of Confederation, or actually we started off with the Articles of Association. Technically, mm-hmm. I started off with the Tory Acts.
Right.
And the forming of the Continental Congress, and then the Articles of Association that, predated the Declaration. We'll read the Declaration in July, but we all know what it said. And mm-hmm. so from that point, they said, okay, we need to create a government, because the Articles of Association just kind of talked about some of economic measures and those types of things that we were going to do. We didn't really form in what we wanted this general government to do, because now that we're independent, we need a little governing body. So they transitioned Continental Congress, because they had already formed it as a body collective to figure out what to do with the hostilities. So they created this Articles of Confederation, and it took a few years to actually ratify, literally four, something like that. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, where the U.S. Constitution was ratified in less than a year.
Right.
It went out in September. It wasn't until Continental Congress forwarded it out in October of 1787, and by... I'm going to say August, they had already had enough states with Virginia in June to form the government. So if the Constitution was ratified very quickly.
Right.
So all of that being said, even faster than the Bill of Rights. That really helps people understand how, it was recognized that this was really needed. And so as we go, we went through the Articles of Confederation, and then we went through the commissions, or the conventions and calls for the Constitutional Convention, and to help priests, set up the stage of what would these men were doing going into the Constitutional Convention. We then now are reading these amendments that came forward of what they needed to do to give Continental Congress to do, to succeed, for this union to succeed. Now, when we were leaving yesterday, because what we want to do is we want to actually close the issue. Do we convene a convention or don't we convene a convention? And was this convention legitimately a runaway convention? So we'll answer all of that once we're done reading here. But you had a question regarding the militia as we were just ending the show.
So we were talking about, you used the term cavalry a couple times, cavalry. And so what I want to get to is, apparently the cavalry was the military of the territories.
So actually, when we look at the Constitution, the territory was under whose jurisdiction?
It was under federal jurisdiction.
There you go. So technically, what was the cavalry?
And so the cavalry was the federal police.
So what executive department managed the cavalry in America?
Well, that would have been, if not the Secretary of War, it would have been whoever the executive
was. It was basically the War Department. It was.
Right.
Right, because it was the army that they had to fund, and they had to fund it every 2 years.
Okay.
Because they needed to bring these states into the Union. So the army was in formation and existed for several decades.
Uh-huh.
And it became... Go ahead.
But the army was federal in the territories and not expected or designed to be in the states. Right.
Well, correct, because once the states became states, it had a part of what it had to do is it had to pick up its responsibility of maintaining, configuring, establishing, configuring, and maintaining a militia.
Okay. Now, here's the other thing I'm curious about. I think this seemed to be understood. In other words, in their day and time, it looked like they did have to explain this to each other. Right? I mean, they didn't have to say, hey, this is a militia, this is how we want to do it. It seemed to be understood. I think the point I want to make is you don't see it a lot of, how should I put this? You just don't see a lot of emphasis on the militia because I believe it was simply part of their understanding. Does that make sense?
Yes, but the paradigms were shifting because, okay. You know, there were, there were people in the States that liked the opportunity of making a career out of fighting engines.
Okay.
And there were people in the States that didn't have any other skills or anything else to do, ruffians or what have you. And what did Teddy Roosevelt call his band in the cavalry?
The Rough Riders.
There you go. So, I mean, this was where men could be men. And, you know, they were out there in the Wild West. And you know, life was constantly dangerous and so forth. My point is that this became this occupation that, you know, a lot of men, if they didn't have anything else to do and they just, you know, they just couldn't figure out, you know, or convince a woman to marry him or what have you, it was the easy thing to do was go join the army and go serve in the territories.
Okay.
And so eventually maybe some of these men settled down in the territories instead of moving into the next territory as it started migrating west, if that makes sense.
Okay. So. Okay.
So my point is that they created an organization that had people going, hey, you know, I don't want to have to find another job. You know, I've been doing this for 15 years. Come on, let me. And this is the same thing with the Department of the Interior.
Okay.
As the West was being formed, and this is actually accounted for in the petition for the Department of Interior, and I think I even account for it in Why Counties Matter Most. I may not have in that because I didn't go after the Department of Interior too much in that. But bottom line, and I know it's in the petition for the Department of Interior, when you look at the contiguous 48 states, by 1849, the United States had formed. Okay. In other words, you know, how much more land was there at the West Coast? I mean, could they continue going west and claiming that land? My point is that was water. There was no more land.
Okay.
In other words, the opportunity had completely dried up because we've already made deals with Britain regarding Canada. Okay. And we formed, the northern border was completely formed by 1849.
Okay.
And if you actually look at the maps of, you know, each deal, each treaty that expanded the territory, so that when we saw the original 13 states and then the original 13 states and their territories, and then the new territory, the Louisiana territory that was added to that, because I believe in 1783, the deal with Britain was that they conceded that we would have all the land between the Atlantic seaboard all the way over to the Mississippi.
Okay.
But not going beyond the Mississippi. So everything west of the Mississippi was Spain or somebody else's.
Okay.
And because remember, Spain and Mexico was claiming the West. But nobody really wanted the West. There were no treasure troves of gold up there, which is why Spain didn't care to occupy, you know, in Nebraska, Montana, the plains, and, you know, all the way down the east side of the Rockies, down until you got to possibly New Mexico, or actually even Texas was still not really well inhabited. That right. was land you had to work to, you know, to make a living, to survive.
So let me see if I understand correctly. The Spanish were interested in gold. This is what it sounds like you're saying. The Spanish were interested in gold, but they weren't interested in working the land.
The Spanish people were getting rich by taking and stealing. They were getting rich. The people in okay. Spain and Portugal became the richest nations very quickly as they started hauling ship after ship after ship with treasures. I mean, there were actually some of those ships that sunk. Mm-hmm. And so we've found some of them, and people have, you know, marauded, and Spain has come forward, or Portugal, and say, hey, that's ours.
Right.
Okay. Because technically they stole that from whom? Right. Yeah. Okay. So they claim that they, you know, it was theirs because it was in their possession, but they stole it. But okay. when you look at the North America, that was not the case. There was no stealing of wealth other than the land itself. And because the Indians didn't see the value, they were not agrarians.
Okay.
Actually, I think when you travel into some of the tribes, they were, but most of the tribes were carnivores, right? I mean, they had a little bit of vegetables in their diet, but they primarily lived off of meat.
So essentially what you're saying is, land wasn't, the idea of owning land was like owning air.
Yeah.
You know, it's, how do you conceive of that, right?
God's creatures live off the land, but not sure. people. People live off the creatures. That was their paradigm. So they laughed at those men who said, hey, what do you want for, you know, this island called Manhattan? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the men, these guys buy this land from us. We'll take those wampums, you know, okay. these nice shiny beads, whatever they were. Yeah, give us, you know, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, how many of those. And they walked away and go, wow, we've got these nice beads. And they have something they can't control.
Right.
And they had no idea of the concept of fencing, the concept of, you know, land control and those types of things. Right. And so when all of a sudden they realized that Manhattan, you know, they owned all of that land, that, okay, you Indians now have to leave. Well, what do you mean, you know, we have to leave? Well, you own this land. And therein lied the wake-up call, you know, that we, these two cultures saw things differently.
Right.
Now, people really don't like it when I say this, and I'm not trying to, you know, infuriate anybody. But the only difference between the Indians and everybody else is that they just had a unique, because, I mean, you found this in suppressed or repressed cultures where, you know, they didn't have a written language, but actually their predecessors, their ancestors actually had a written language.
Mm.
So in other words, here was a society, because when you look at the Aztecs, when you look at the Mayans, the Incas, there were written languages clearly. So how is it that the descendants of these people, you know, went backwards and we're happy living backwards?
And that's an interesting question.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, they lived, I mean, how many centuries, thousands of years from the fall of the Aztec, you know, dynasty, whatever, to, you know, they lived thousands of years based on folklore and no written word. And they created these roles. And when you really look at the American Indian, though there were some, just very few, that had a different paradigm, like the Navajo, I believe they believed in the property of the land, you know, okay. and they were tied to that land. That was their land. And right. so they themselves, I think they actually live on the land of their forefathers. But the majority of the American tribes were nomadic. They migrated with the bison. They migrated with, you know, the animals that they lived off of. Mm-hmm. And then some of them, like they're, you know, the Indians in the Northeast or what have you, they were quasi-agrarian, you know, carnivore, what have you. But because they did grow corn and or food, vegetables. So, mm-hmm. in other words, they had some ties to the land, but most Indian tribes didn't. Most didn't. Now, things changed because some of those who had ties, like the Cherokee, and, you know, there's a lot of misinformation regarding the Indians and our history with them. And the best book that actually and academically lays out really what happened and how things happened is A Patriot's View of America by Allen and Swigert. It's a thick book, but it is really worth reading because they actually discover and they go through some things that are very interesting. As a matter of fact, another book I really enjoyed reading was J.M. Roberts, or I think it's J.M. Roberts, World History. And in his book, in J.M. Roberts' History of the World, and it's a very thick book, in that book, he basically identifies that a uniqueness was discovered in America, that there was a direct association to the people of Israel, or at least maybe not at that, because they didn't have genetics or anything, so they didn't know whether there was a genetic tie, but they had very unique, similar cultural perspectives. Both people of Israel, as well as some of the American Indian tribes. And I think there were quite a few tribes in America that believed they were the chosen people.
What was the name of this book? A History of the World by who?
J.M. Roberts.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, how did people halfway across the world come to believing that they were God's chosen people when, you know, that actually was really... The only other place that actually came to fruition was in Israel. I mean, you know, Egypt, the pharaohs believed they were gods, you know, and mm-hmm. but there were always those types of things. But the concept of, you know, being God's people was very unique to Israel. And then all of a sudden, the archaeologists and so forth kind of discovered that was a part of the folklore of some of the American Indian tribes.
Right.
But the reason that it may not have been a prevailing thought with all of them was because they actually, like I said, they disavowed themselves to their previous society. So whatever was kept is what they chose to edit out.
All right. Give me that author's name one more time.
I believe it's J.M. Roberts. Okay. I will send you the link, and I actually have the audiobook, so we can talk about that. But okay. Bottom line is we want to get into Article 18 and 19.
Oh, yeah.
Because sure. We still have to discuss this. But, yeah, the cavalry, I hope we ran this to fruition. The cavalry became this huge employer for a long period of time, right? A half century, actually more than that, because many of the Western states didn't become states until the 1880s or so. So right. They maintained the need for a cavalry all that time. And at the same point in time, they started creating this permanency of land management with the Department of Interior. Why? Because the federal government started assuming powers over land not delegated. In other words, mm-hmm. the Constitution enumerates properties, and it did not enumerate properties for Indians, you know, forests or resources or anything like that. And so when the federal government started making claims and basically telling states that you had to concede to us this land, they don't have that authority. It's right there in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, that they have to buy that land from the states. Any land that they take, and the only land that they can take that they pay for, or 16, Subsection 16, I think it's 16, with, you know, the enumeration of the exclusive clause, the exclusive legislation, and so forth. When you read that clause, you know, when the federal government takes land for a fort, magazine, shipyard, or needful buildings, they have to pay the state for that. Mm-hmm. And so, and down the road, they started saying, oh, well, we'll just lease that land instead of paying for it, because they knew as the United States shifted, they needed to have forts in the far west, you know, until they got to the Pacific Ocean, you know, just to guard the, you know, the western flank of the nation. So many of the forts and so forth, as they, you know, managed everything and got things into a civil order, some of those forts actually just died, or they, you know, closed them down.
Sure.
Because they didn't need them anymore. So they, that's why they went to leasing. But anyway, go ahead. Let's read 18.
Okay. So are we reading 18 or 19?
Did you just read 18?
No. Okay. It looks like I did.
Okay. So I didn't think so. So go ahead.
All right. In case it shall hereafter be found necessary by Congress to establish any new systems of revenue and to make any new regulations in the finances of the U.S. for a limited term not exceeding 15 years in their operation for supplying the common treasury with monies for defraying all charges of war and all other expenses that shall be incurred for the common defense or general welfare, and such new systems or regulations shall be agreed to and adopted by the United States and Congress assembled, and afterwards be confirmed by the legislatures of 11 states, and in that proportion, when there shall be more than 13 states in the Union, the same shall become binding on all the states as fully as if the legislatures of all the states should confirm the same. Quick question here.
Yes.
So many of these required 9 states. This one says 11. What's the difference?
I don't know. But they wanted to amend this and actually at least have not a unanimity where it required all the states, but they still had maybe, you know, let's keep that threshold high. Let's make it 80%.
Okay.
Whatever.
Okay.
Okay. So Article 19.
All right. The United States and Congress assembled shall have the sole and exclusive power of declaring what offenses against the United States shall be deemed treason and what offenses against the same misprision of treason. Misprision? Do you know what this word is?
No, I don't, but that's okay.
Okay. And what offenses shall be deemed piracy or felonies in the high seas, and to annex suitable punishments to all the offenses aforesaid respectively, and power to institute a federal judicial court for trying and punishing all officers appointed by Congress for all crimes, offenses, and misbehavior in their offices, and to which court and appeal shall be allowed from the judicial courts of the several states in all causes wherein questions shall arise on the meaning and construction of treaties entered into by the United States with any foreign power, or on the law of nations, or wherein any question shall arise respecting any regulations that may hereafter be made by Congress relative to trade and commerce.
Hold up right there. So let's stop there because we got 1 minute. And so you're seeing some of the things that they didn't mention in a previous article or a previous amendment of the general clauses. They actually now just threw in the powers over very specific crimes: treason, crimes committed on the high seas, and crimes committed against the laws of nations. So this actually went into the new Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm telling you, let's get through all of this. But the fact is really becoming more and more clear that they realized that the Articles of Confederation did not contain enough sufficient for them to be able to, you know, serve the Union in the way a general government really needed to serve the Union. And so they said, hey, we need to be able to do these things, because it's one thing to have somebody commit treason against your state, but what about treason against the Union? And so it begged all of these questions, it begged these amendments, and so we're going to go into break literally right now. So we'll be right back, you know, we'll bring Paul back with us in just a minute, because it's just a promo. But folks, It's really clear that when you really look at the Constitution that we have and you look at the Articles of Confederation, pretty much what ended up coming out of the Constitution were many of these amendments that they needed. So we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we continue on, so let's go ahead and pick it up where you left off here, and that was at the end of Congress relative to trade and commerce.
Me made by Congress relative to trade and commerce, or the collection of federal revenues pursuant to powers that shall be vested in that body, or wherein questions of importance may arise, and the United States shall be a party, provided that the trial of the fact by jury shall ever be held sacred, and also the benefits of the writ of habeas corpus, provided also that no member of Congress or officer holding any other office under the United States shall be a judge of said court, and a said court shall consist of 7 judges to be appointed from the different parts of the Union, to wit, 1 from New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, 1 from Massachusetts, 1 from New York and New Jersey, 1 from Pennsylvania, 1 from Delaware and Maryland, 1 from Virginia, and 1 from North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, and 4 of whom shall be a quorum to do business.
Okay, so when we're looking at what they're laying out, then they're basically saying we need to set up a judiciary, and we need to be able to punish these very specific crimes and define those punishments. And so, because we're starting to have these problems, I mean, it's interesting that, why would they ask for this if they didn't see the need for it? In other words, they already saw people committing crimes.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I guess they weren't a bunch of saints back in those days, that they actually had some people that were unsavory. Let's just say that. Okay. So Article 20, and this goes for, it's a long one, but it's not as long. But go ahead.
Sure. Article 20. That due attention may be given to the affairs of the Union early in the federal year, and the sessions of Congress may, as short as conveniently, and the sessions of Congress made, as short as conveniently may be, each state shall elect her delegates annually before the 1st of July, and make it their duty to give an answer before the 1st of September in every year whether they accept their appointments or not, and make effectual provision for filling the places of those who may decline before the 1st of October yearly, and to transmit to Congress by the 10th of the same month the names of the delegates who shall be appointed and accept their appointments, and it shall be the indispensable duty of delegates to make a representation of their state in Congress on the first Monday in November annually. And if any delegate or delegates, when required by Congress to attend so far as may be necessary to keep up a representation of each state in Congress, or having taken his or their seat, shall withdraw without leave of Congress unless recalled by the state, he or they shall be proceeded against as Congress shall direct, provided no punishment shall be further extended than to disqualifications any longer to be members of Congress or to hold any office of trust or profit under the United States or under any individual state, and the several states shall adopt regulations effectual to the attainment of the ends of this article.
So are you getting the sense that maybe they were seeing that even public servants weren't behaving well?
Yes. Isn't that interesting?
Uh-huh. Right. So, okay. So now let's kind of sum this all up, because we got a good 20 minutes, 22, 23 minutes. We saw the development of the demand of the inalienable rights as Britons basically started taking advantage. And when we talk about advantage, we're not talking about, you know, taking 20% of your pay and basically, you know, in addition to that, taking a good part of, you know, your income for property tax and all of these different forms of government has basically thrown you up against the wall, you know, kind of shackled you and has just got their hands in your wallet, bleeding you dry.
Mm-hmm.
And in truth, the British government was laying taxes to pay for the war upon the American colonists, but it was a fraction of a percent. In most cases, it really wasn't that onerous. But the reason why they said this is intolerable, because we have no representation. Mm-hmm. We believe that we should have representation in Parliament. No taxation without representation. Folks, we're being taxed to the teeth. And boy, how well do you believe you're being represented as they start watering and been watering down our representation to where it's 1,000,000 people to 1?
Right.
So they revolted, said, hey, we have rights as Englishmen. You need to respect the fact that we're Englishmen. And they just turned their back towards the colonists, which forced them to leave what they felt was the best government in the world.
Sure.
And so it pained them. I mean, they came out of their way when we read the Articles of Association to say, we are the most faithful servants.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to basically respond to your behavior by not giving trade with you and doing this and doing that and shutting down your slave trade, right? That was in the Articles of Association.
You know, it sounds to me like repeated petitions were repeatedly ignored. They'd finally gotten to the place where they had to do something to survive.
Correct. Okay, so now we declared this Declaration of Independence under the Articles of Association, which forced us to create a government. And that government was formed in the next year haphazardly by the delegates at Continental Congress without the tranquility of peace, always looking over their shoulders. So they were in, I'll just say, really in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
The exigencies of the time, they needed to get this done, so they just did it, and they basically said, okay, we're going to make it so that everybody has to agree before we make any changes, and we're all going to do this. And then they basically signed this, or they sent this out to the states to say, ratify this, and it took 4 years.
Mm.
4 years to ratify the Articles of Confederation. That's how good they were. And actually, you know, you would have thunk that it would have taken just a matter of a couple months, because they still didn't like some of the powers that were being delegated in the Articles of Confederation.
Right.
The states really wanted to have their own cabals. They understood the necessity of the union, but they didn't care to pay for it.
Mm. Okay.
And so as we were wrapping up, because in 1781 to 1783, we were wrapping up the Revolutionary War. And actually, it did wrap up in 1783. I believe it was June of 1783. Just 3 months later, the war was over.
Right.
After it was ratified. And so the states started behaving badly, but we already saw before it was ratified a couple of amendments, two amendments come forward. And so they kept on identifying, wow, you know, we really had a shortfall. So they had this big, huge amendment of giving them the power to be able to do all of these, you know, what you just think is perfunctory, just things that, you know, are in the sauce, things that you just needed to do because it's good work. I mean, it's, you know, it maintains sanity and it maintains sanitary conditions, whatever. You know, we got to clean up after ourselves. You would think that sometimes those things would just go unsaid, but to be clear, this was a government that did not have general powers. This was a government that had delegated powers. So they couldn't just presume that they could start writing on something other than parchment or paper.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just saying the fact is that they were really contained pretty tightly. And so this is why we saw all of these amendments. And over the course of the next 4 years, from 1783 to 1787, it became plainer and plainer and plainer that they needed more powers and they needed to be able to have, you know, the punishment, the definition of a few crimes, counterfeiting and treason, as well as crimes committed on the high seas and crimes committed against the laws of nations. We just read this stuff. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that they didn't have was the oath, and that's why one of the things that really stood out of the ratification base was the oath. There were a lot of things that, you know, the Constitution refined a lot. But I'm telling you that everything the Continental Congress needed, and they were haranguing, going, you've got to give us these things. That was all disclosed.
Right.
So when these men were basically in 1786, when this last recommendation for amendments went out and it went unanswered, in a month later, in September, the states of New York, Virginia, and a couple of other states, I think Pennsylvania was one of them, pretty much the bigger states. And so even though the bigger states, you know, put up the biggest resistance, the smaller states were really some of the worst. I mean, look at Rhode Island. It was one of the smallest states in the Union. And they ran up their currency. They inflated their currency so bad that it was really worthless. But, I mean, they did such bad things as a small state.
Right.
And so the small states, Delaware and most of the small states, jumped on board and actually quickly ratified this Constitution a lot faster than the big states who actually were in that initial convention saying, we need to have a constitutional convention to fix these articles. Mm-hmm. So my point is as we've laid it all out for the people, for you, the listeners, do you think that they did anything nefarious that was outside the scope and outside what was already common knowledge?
Oh, you mean the calling for a convention?
Because they called for the convention, and every state, and we actually read the commissions, and the commission said, cooperate with each state and do what you believe is necessary to save the Union.
Right.
Come on. If that's not, you know, it's these men were honorable men, and the men that they sent, they had absolute and blind faith, trust. The fact that some people said, oh, these men violated their commission. And even though you may have actually said, it had some of the men that went to the convention actually say that, like George Mason, you know, this really, I mean, George Mason was such a good man, and he had these hardcore principles. He still voted against the Constitution. And I'm going, you know, some people are so stubborn that they'll never see the light of day.
Yeah.
And so there's no doubt in my mind that when you look at these men that used hyperbole to say, oh, yeah, we exceeded our commission, or they exceeded their commission, I'm telling you, folks, that that was probably more based on blind conceit than it was on objective analysis and objective commentary. Because I don't believe that any of these men violated their commission, and Madison even stated so in Federalist Paper number 40.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, he pointed out, and he actually said this, that many of the parts of the Articles of Confederation were transferred and used line by line, verbatim, the exact same words.
Mm-hmm.
And so they not only did that, but they incorporated many of these improvements that the Continental Congress was looking for.
And that they had stated early.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that it wasn't, I mean, I don't know that the ink was really that dry on the Articles of Confederation when they realized that there were some things that it needed.
Right. So what we have to do is actually come down to the ultimate, what is the truth? Did the state's delegates go into this convention and actually commit? And so, Paul, while you're sitting here, while I'm doing this diatribe, look up runaway.
Okay.
Look up runaway. Right, by definition, what is runaway? What does that really mean? Because when these men were going in to do the job that the states had commissioned them to do, to fix the Constitution, to give them the necessary government with enough energy to basically preserve the Union.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, tell
Let's
me.
See what we got here.
Okay, this is away. The definition. Is okay. Merriam-Webster? What are we looking at? Oxford?
Okay, so we're actually just looking at dictionary.com, but I can go deeper.
Okay, that's fine. What's dictionary.com?
A person who has run away, especially from their family or an institution. Let's see. Denoting something happening or done quickly, easily, or uncontrollably, or an animal. Animal or vehicle that is running out of control. Let me go to Oxford.
Yeah, okay. Because okay. As you look this up, I believe that the term abandoned is truly the best synonym for runaway for these delegates. And so there's no doubt in my mind that these delegates that went, the only ones that would feel like they abandoned were those who refused to sign and continued to fight the ratification of the Constitution because they, for some reason, over whatever principle they had, was, you know, I'll just say firm in their conviction that they didn't want to have this much power in a general government, that they wanted to maintain the sovereignty of the states and allow the states full, you know, our carte blanche authority over all things, and basically have an impotent general government. So what did you find out?
Okay, so I went to Cambridge. Okay.
Okay.
Let's see. Having escaped or run away from somewhere out of control, runaway successes. Let's see. And then it's got some similar words or phrases, amok, crazily, madding, maniacally. I'm trying to find something that's waywardly, that's what they've come up with.
So in some ways, the runaway is being portrayed as chaotic. In other words, all right. Of a sudden, it's just out of control. These guys just went chaotic. Do you think right. What they created in that Constitution, it resembles any sense of a chaotic document?
No, it seems more orderly. than anything else.
Oh, absolutely. There you go. Yeah.
And not only orderly, but measured.
Succinct, concise, deliberate, yes. Measured, yes. But abandoned, chaotic?
No. In fact, if anything, I think the articles were chaotic. You know, like you said, they were produced as we were coming out of war. We were going into war. Right.
We were literally going into war where those things were written.
Right. And so we needed something like I said, you know, a few days ago, they had to do something. Two, they recognized it had needs, but it was a transition. It was transition is not the word I'm looking for. It was a, what do they call it? I hate that when I... You'll know what it is. It's probably right on the edge of your head, but okay, it'll come back to me. But the point was that it didn't start out with being exactly what they needed, but experience taught them, oh, we can do this better, or we can do this better. And as we are reading the proposed amendments, you're seeing elements of the Constitution in these amendments.
Right.
Okay. They didn't just suddenly come up with it. This had been brewing for a while, and they knew the ideas they needed. Right. So they incorporated them into the Constitution.
Right. So when we look at some of the new things that actually came in, you know, that was a part of this Constitution that was really, you know, not something that they were even thinking about, was the division of the magistrate.
Correct.
In other words, creating checks and balances where the president had, you know, a little positive power with legislation via treaty, and negative powers basically being able to veto things that Congress wanted to do. So there was the checks and balances that they created in addition to this, I'll just say, the shifting of the magistrate into a stable government that had these, again, I call them horizontal checks and balances. Across the board within the federal government, there were these different checks and balances. Mm-hmm. There was vertical checks and balances where the states, the people, or actually, if you put it in context, if we start at the foundation, we the people are the foundation. We institute our government and we create counties. Our counties become fundamentally our direct government. That's the one we create. Then our counties pull delegates together and they create the state. And then the states pulled delegates together, and then they created the federal government. So,
right.
So as we start looking at this vertical checks and balances, we, the people, have to use that chain of command to make sure that when the federal government is misbehaving, hey, county commissioners, are you aware of this? And are you aware of the fact that the states are letting them get away with this?
Correct.
That's why we have integrated this whole the full chain of command to get involved, because the one government that means the most to us, where the most tyranny is coming from, is our county government.
Right.
So,
and it's not being seen, by the way, right now.
Right. So because it's become administrators for the bureaucracy and the state and federal government. They're just administrative bodies, when that actually is the furthest thing from the truth. Many of the things that they're doing are not delegated to them. The whole point and the reason why we the people institute government, and we institute them with constitutions, is the concept that we delegate very specific powers and only those powers. So when we see the government is doing something that they don't have the power delegated, then it's our job to hold them accountable if it's the county commissioners. If it's the federal legislators, then, you know, they represent us as well. Mm-hmm. Or even the state legislatures, they all represent us. That's right. Why at all three levels, we have direct representation.
So, by the way, you brought up counties, and I thought you probably ought to bring up your document, because I think I heard you say that you finally published it, Why Counties Matter Most.
Yep. Okay. So it is on, and you can go get it. It's posted on Reclaiming the Republic Constitutional Perspectives. And so the article that was up there for the longest time has now moved, and it is over on Constitutional Articles. The constitutional and jurisdictional limitation of the federal government is no longer there. That is now on the Constitutional Articles page, and the Constitutional Perspective now has the 72 or 73 pages of the Why Counties Matter Most.
There it is, new article. There it is, Why Counties Matter Most, An Architectural and Functional View.
There you go.
Final draft. Okay. Well, I'm going to... We probably ought to read this sometimes.
Well,
73 pages, that'll take us a while.
Yeah, it would. And I think it may be better to just kind of go through some of the sections and why those sections were included, so that people can go, oh my gosh, this is a gold mine. Because there's a... let me go to, because I had it here. I don't have it up, so I can pull it up real quick. If I look at Why Counties Matter Most, and I look at the citations that I put in this document, right?
Okay.
How many citations do you think it has?
I'm just now loading it up, so I don't know yet.
Okay, let's just say... If it's 70 pages, a citation per page, maybe?
Oh, you got... I reviewed this earlier, and I'm guessing that you got quite a few more than one citation per
page. So I'm looking at the last page that has 106, but there are some links in the following pages that will take you to, which basically are the citations in the appendix. And there's, you know, two or so. So there's probably... you know, about 110, you know, links to the documents and citations that I've kind of tucked into this. So this is really packed with a lot of content, a lot of information that has been assembled out of, you know, these documents by the framers. I mean, many of them are citations from the Constitution, from the ratification debates, and some of them, or a lot of them, are citations in direct relationship to specific acts like the Enabling Acts and so forth. So I repeat some of the citations, or I should say I repeat this citing the same documents, because many of the important things need to be highlighted. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to really create encapsulate a whole argument why counties really matter most.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully you get it, folks. Hopefully this helps. And by the way, it's free. So with that, I don't think we could end it with a better note. It's free, folks. So go get it and read it, because it's not about, you know, trying to make an enterprise out of saving the Republic. It is about literally getting you to help save the Republic. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. And we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort.
We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.